the message that they're sending is, if you think you can rely on your constitution, in this case, the Grundgesetz, if you think you can rely on your constitutional rights, if you think you can, if you think the rule of law will defend you, think again, because we don't care. We're going to hurt you because we have the power to do it. And all of those democratic rights that you thought that you had that would protect you from this, they don't mean shit to us.
A very warm welcome to CJ Hopkins. Thanks for taking the time for an interview.
Bastian, thanks for having me.
I'd like to introduce you. You are an award-winning playwright, novelist, and political satirist. At least one of your books has been practically censored. We talked about this, and we will talk about it more, in Germany. Its title is The Rise of the New Normal Reich. You have lived in Berlin for 20 years and are married to a Jewish woman. Your latest book is called Fear and Loathing in the New Normal Reich. There we have it again. And I'd like to tell a little bit of your story that we will talk about more just in a, just in some moments. The Berlin State Prosecutor has accused you, I have to read this, of disseminating unconstitutional National Socialist Organization symbols because of Twitter posts you made. These posts also showed the cover of your book, I already said, The Rise of the New Normal Reich, on which a mask with a transparent swastika can be seen. After an acquittal, the state prosecutor's office appealed and won the case in September 2024. You then lodged an appeal, and this case is still pending. And we already did an interview with you and your lawyer about this case. And now the reason why we're sitting here is I have an interest in the New Normal Reich and what you write, but there's a very current thing that happened, because 10 days ago, three armed police officers stood in front of your door with a search warrant and searched your home, interrogated you and your wife, and confiscated your computer. What happened, and why were these people there in your home?
Okay, yeah, the police raid last Wednesday, this was based on a new investigation. So not the original charges and the original prosecution that you just explained, but a new investigation that is focused on the book itself, the same book. The search warrant, it was to allow the police to search my apartment for evidence that I am the publisher and the distributor, and that I promote this book, which I am. It's kind of crazy, because there's no secret about this. It says so right on my websites. I have stated this in court. You know, anyone knows that I'm the publisher and that I promote my book. They were also searching for evidence that I own and operate my blog, The Consent Factory. Most of my columns are out on Substack now, but I still keep the blog up. I copy everything to my blog as well. Again, if you just look at the blog, it says right there that I am the owner and operator of the blog. And the other thing they were interested in was a column that I wrote after my acquittal was overturned by the Kammergericht. Mm-hmm. I wrote about this, and again, I posted the cover image of the book alongside the cover of Der Spiegel, where Der Spiegel put a big swastika on the cover and covered it with a German flag, making the point, you know, my book, it shows the image, there's the swastika, and it's covered with a medical mask. So it's exactly the same artistic concept. Anyway, the police were interested in that as well, according to the search warrant. So yeah, theoretically, they were looking for evidence that I am the publisher of my book and that I promote my book. which I do.
Yeah.
So it's all kind of insane, really.
Mm. And do you know by now who started this investigation? What was the reason for this investigation? Are there any new hints?
No, we don't have the, my lawyer has asked, you know, for the case file so we can respond, to it. But, I assume it's initiated by the Berlin State Prosecutor. Mm-hmm. Again, I think that's how it works. The prosecutor notifies the police and then the police carry out the search.
Mm. And I already said that your book is practically censored in Germany, because when I was preparing this interview, I tried to buy your book on the internet. I was going to one of the biggest websites, buch.de, and other websites, of course, and I just couldn't find it. And I also read posts of you wanting to know who actually is responsible for that. Do you know by now why I, as a German citizen, cannot buy your book in Germany? I can't even buy it in a bookstore, it seems like.
Well, this is where it gets all very strange and Kafkaesque, and it's very strange to me, the logic of it. I have to go back. In August of 2022, the book had been published. I published the book in May of 2022. And it was, available all over the world, being distributed all over the world, including in Germany. And in August of 2022, this is when the original investigation concerning these two tweets started. This is when the Bundeskriminalamt was notified, and the Berlin State Prosecutor started their criminal investigation. This is the same time that Amazon banned the book officially. They wrote to me, and I have published the emails, the email exchange that we had when they banned the book in Germany, Austria, and the Netherlands. This is the same time Twitter then, of course, censored the tweets. This is also when the book was removed from distribution in Germany, and it became unavailable. You couldn't get it anywhere. Journalists have looked into this and have spoken to the authorities. And as far as I know, and as far as these journalists know, the authorities claim that the book is not banned. So the book is not illegal. And yet that is the grounds for this new investigation, and was the grounds for the search warrant and the police raid that was carried out to find evidence that I'm the publisher and the promoter of a book that is not illegal, right?
Mm.
Technically, apparently this, and this is secondhand, but what one journalist heard from the police is that, okay, the book is not illegal, but the cover is illegal. Right. So my book is not banned. Mm. It's only the cover that's banned, as if the cover was not part of the book. Right.
Yeah.
this logic, of course, drives me crazy, because, of course, the cover and the artwork on the cover, and I'll give a shout out to my cover artist, Anthony Freda, who's a brilliant artist, lives in New York. Of course, the cover is part of the book. You can't take the cover off the book and say it's still the book any more than you could take a chapter out of the book and say, oh, it's still the book, right? It's the artwork exists as a whole. So I think, and I don't know, again, we have to get the case file so we can get the details from the authorities, but the argument seems to be that my book is not banned in Germany, but the cover of the book is illegal. And I don't even know what that is based on, other than, you know, my current conviction, you know, by the Kammergericht that overturned my acquittal, which case is still being reviewed by the Bundesverfassungsgericht, right? We're waiting for a decision on that. So I don't know how to answer this question. It is effectively banned, and it has been since 2022. There's a lot of, you know, sophistry and, you know, and bullshit around it. But the fact of the matter is it has been banned in Germany for almost 3 years. Yeah.
And you said it's a best-selling book in other countries.
It's my best-selling book.
It's your best-selling book.
It was a bestseller on, I think, Amazon and Barnes & Noble when it was released. Mm-hmm. But it is my best-selling book by far all over the world, you know, in the USA, in the UK, Canada, Australia, you know, everywhere else, yeah. And, you know, and again, you know, just part of the insanity of this fixation that the authorities have on the cover. You know, there's not a German cover. There's only one cover for the book, and the book is distributed, you know, internationally, you know, by Amazon and by Ingram Content Group, which is the largest book distributor in the world, which, you know, all publishers use. The big five publishers, all publishers use them. I don't know. It's kind of crazy. We have to get the details about this new investigation so that my lawyer can respond to it. And then I'll know more.
And when the people who know your work and your essays about totalitarianism and what happened in the COVID era, it's not funny, but it's almost comic to realize that you get this search warrant and people coming to you searching for your book and whatever, because it so fits to what you're saying. So have you actually digested it? Like being in contact with the human embodiment of this totalitarianism, have you digested what happened there?
Not completely. There's a part of me that is not at all surprised. I've been writing this for many years. I've been telling people that what we are experiencing is a system that is evolving gradually towards a new form of totalitarianism, not 20th century totalitarianism, a new form of totalitarianism that we don't understand. And this, I was saying this before COVID. Yeah. Mm. So there's a part of me that's not surprised at all, because this is what totalitarian systems do. But there is another part of me that can't believe it, that's shocked. I mean, I'm not an activist. I'm not a, you know, revolutionary. I'm a writer. I'm an author. You know, I write things, and publish books every once in a while. You know, the idea that the police would need to raid my home, because of that is just mind-boggling to me. But, it was also, you know, mind-boggling to me that I was prosecuted for two tweets. Mm-hmm. This, you know, to me, this is also, you know, on the one hand, it's insanity and it's madness, and on the other hand, it's not surprising, because this is what totalitarian systems do. They use people as examples to try to intimidate everyone else. I've made this point many times. I say it's not, you know, this case, it's not really about me, you know, and trying to silence me. I think they know at this point that they're not going to silence me. The point is to make an example of me for everyone else. So when people are about to express their opinion or about to write something or publish something, and they think, well, wait a minute, do I want what happened to Hopkins to happen to me? That's the point of this.
Mm. Actually, after our interview last time, I thought, am I allowed to put your cover into my article about our interview? Are we starting to guess or to wonder if I'm... And now the becoming like the target of an investigation. I did it anyway, because I thought this can't be real. But just to the legal side of it, I wrote about this case, and there's a judge, actually, Dr. Clivia von Davids, and she wrote about your case, and she's actually specialized in this field. And she says that it says that if you use those symbols, it needs to be clear that it's intended to continue the efforts of a former National Socialist organization. That needs to be behind the symbol. Yeah. And that is only then it's liable to prosecution, you know, and if it's not intended, which is, at least to me, it was obvious in your case, because you are criticizing these ways and using a symbol that Germans, of course, you know, and there is a tradition or history. But this legal point was really important to me because, as you said, the Spiegel, and I think also the Stern, because I made also a little picture of it, they use this symbol, the swastika, openly, and it's okay. So it seems like your legal case should be clear, but it isn't, and you have to wait what the result will be.
Well, the legal case actually is very clear, and it's let me say one thing before I say the next. What people also need to understand is that this book cover and my, you know, term, the new normal Reich, you know, none of this was directed at Germany. Mm. You know, this book, yes, there are essays about Germany because I live here and that's where I experienced those years. But most of the essays are about the USA and the UK and Australia and Canada and the entire world. None of this was directed at Germany, right? The judge in my first case, in the Amtsgericht, she understood the law very well, just like Clivia von Davids understands the law. As you said, she's an expert in it. And I understand the law. Of course, I understand the law. And of course, I looked into the law before we created this artwork and put it on the cover of my book. A lot of people are surprised to hear that I don't have a problem with this law. I actually support this law. I don't want to see neo-Nazis running around in the streets of Berlin waving swastikas. The reason, as a free speech absolutist or almost absolutist, the reason I can support this law is the exceptions to the ban are written very clearly into the law. Livia von Davids cited those in her analyses. The judge in my first case understood those exceptions very well. Of course, there's an exception for art, and of course, there's an exception for history that doesn't really apply in my case. The art does. But the main exception that applies is using these symbols to oppose anti-constitutional activity. Right? This is what Der Spiegel was doing on the cover of their magazine. It's what Stern was doing on the cover of their magazine. They were comparing the AfD, to the Nazis. Right? Of course, it's what I'm doing on the cover of my book. I was comparing the authoritarianism of the COVID regime during that time to the rise of the Nazis. We were all doing exactly the same thing. The judge in my first case understood that, acknowledged that. She did not like me at all. She called me names, but she acquitted me because she followed the law. This is a long way of saying the legal case is actually not complicated at all. The German authorities are instrumentalizing the law. They're perverting the law, and they are using the law as a weapon to punish a COVID dissident, to make an example and intimidate me, but mostly to intimidate everyone else into silence. All right? It's a lot of people get caught up in the legal arguments, and I try to steer them away from that. And I'll explain the legal arguments just like I did very quickly. And I try to tell them, that's not what this story is about. What this story is about, it's about the authorities perverting the law, making a mockery of the rule of law, using the law to punish people and to intimidate people. When a government, when authorities decide to do that, the law will not help you. the law will not help you because they've already dispensed with any respect for the law.
So it's also a demonstration of power.
Yes, it's primarily a demonstration of power. Hmm. It's primarily a show of force. The message that they're sending is, if you think you can rely on your constitution, in this case, the Grundgesetz, if you think you can rely on your constitutional rights, if you think the rule of law will defend you, think again.
Hmm.
Because we don't care. We're going to hurt you because we have the power to do it. And all of those democratic rights that you thought that you had that would protect you from this, they don't mean shit to us.
Hmm.
That's the message that's being sent.
Which fits completely in the COVID era, because there was a lot of rights people thought they have and then were just gone overnight or in some months. So it fits in the narrative or in an evolving process, basically.
Well, I think you probably know, because you're familiar with my writing, I think that was the primary point of the authoritarianism during the COVID era. I mean, this gets complicated, but basically the whole COVID event happened after 4 or 5 years of kind of right populist rebellion, against the advance of the new global capitalist system that we all live under. And then, whoops, here comes, an apocalyptic plague, and we have to suspend the Constitution and lock everyone down in their homes and make them wear silly masks on their faces, that 2 weeks ago we told you we're not going to help you against a respiratory virus, but now today it's going to help you against it. So everyone has to wear these and stand, in funny places facing the wall and elevate. All of this, to me, the way I analyzed it, all of this was sending that same message. It's that same show of force. It's basically the powers that be speaking to the people and saying, obviously, you forgot who's in charge. So we're going to remind you.
And that so fits to the narrative of people were told, you are not protected against corona. There's no way you're not protected. So you are afraid. But what you are saying also, and I felt it this way, you are not protected from the state anymore. You thought you got rights to protect you. Yeah. Maybe you thought you got an immune system that could protect you. Well, you know what? Both is gone now.
Right.
So, and that leaves people very vulnerable to whatever comes.
Well, it leaves people terrified.
Terrified.
And people who are terrified are easy to manipulate.
Hmm. And is that... because we've talked about your book now so many times and people, and, I read some of it. You've already started describing it. What's the new normal Reich for you what are the maybe most important aspects of this new normal Reich that you write about?
This is, Bastian, I am primarily, I'm a writer, I'm an author, I'm a political satirist. I mean, primarily I'm an entertainer, right? This, but I do get serious and I try to provide some serious analysis. And this is basically the serious analysis that I've been trying to provide for years. And the simple version of the message is that, when the Cold War ended, the last real ideological conflict dissolved and it was over. We became a one ideology world, a one power system world. And that's a very complex power system that people don't understand yet. But I believe that we became a one ideological power system world. And that system doesn't have any outside enemies anymore. It doesn't have any ideological adversaries anymore. So what does it have left to do? Right? Well, what it has to do is what any occupying force has to do in a territory. I've referred to the military term clear and hold. Mm-hmm. So basically, imagine that you are this new ideological power system that came into being just 35 years ago, basically. And now you occupy the entire territory of the planet, right? There are no outside enemies anymore. So what's left to do? Well, what's left is to identify pockets of internal resistance, any kind of resistance, resistance from the right, resistance from the left, Islamic fundamentalism, Christian fundamentalism, it doesn't matter. Any resistance to you and this new system, right? And the other thing that you have left to do is to consolidate your ideology, right? And make it uniform. In other words, once a system controls the entire territory of the planet, it doesn't have anything else to do other than evolve toward totalitarianism.
Mm-hmm. Right? So it goes inward, kind of.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And as it goes inward, it also evolves in a more and more authoritarian fashion, and ultimately to totalitarianism. And again, and I want to emphasize this, it's not 20th century totalitarianism. I'm not talking about the former Soviet Union. I'm not talking about the Nazis. There aren't going to be, you know, goons running around with jackboots, you know, waving big swastikas or, you know, any of that. It's what I'm talking about is a system that is evolving into a new form of totalitarianism that none of us really understand yet. It's just beginning. There are a lot of similarities to the older forms, but there are a lot of differences as well. When I talk about the new normal Reich, and the reason that I use that title is that I want to evoke everything that I just tried to explain right now. Again, it's not Germany, if the German authorities are listening to this. You know, I'm talking about the global system that we all live under, and it's global capitalism. I have a lot of conservative readers, and they don't like it when I talk about capitalism. And I have nothing against capitalism per se. I like buying things, and I like owning private property. What I'm talking about is the ideological system that encompasses the entire planet. I believe, and I think I can demonstrate, that it is relentlessly, gradually evolving along a trajectory towards a new form of totalitarianism. So that's the new normal Reich. Mm.
So you don't see the world, or maybe you see, but partly not as, or there's a multipolar world, there's China, and there's Russia, and there's the States, because a lot of geopolitics would describe our situation in those terms. They would say it's like there's an imperium, and, you know, there's Russia, and then there's BRICS, and we all have these people are analyzing the state in these terms. But sure, when I listen to you, I hear that there's something behind this, or there's a bigger picture that says it's actually one thing. Is that correct?
Yes. And of course, both are correct. Of course, there's competition between China and the US and the West and, you know, and Russia. And just like there's competition between Coke and Pepsi and, you know, McDonald's and Burger King. Of course, there is competition within the system. Again, what I'm talking about is not 20th century totalitarianism. So yes, there is intramural competition, just like corporations compete with each other. You know, nations and blocks of nations and alliances are going to compete with each other, but none of them are going to challenge the system that they are a part of. And they're all a part of it, even Russia, which is obviously, you know, in an intramural sense, Russia is struggling to hold on to what's left of its sovereignty. Mm. Yeah. And its, you know, culture. But at the same time, it's completely integrated in the global capitalist system, as is China. You know, the system that I'm talking about, You know, it's not a bunch of guys sitting in a room.
Yeah.
It's an ideological system that generates our values and generates what we think of as reality.
Mm.
Yeah. And none of these multipolar forces are challenging that system itself.
And sometimes you write about new world order, or you already said global capitalists, totalitarianism. But for you, if I understand it right, it's a system. It's not a group of people or institutions, because when I talk about or debate about who is doing what and pulling the strings or whatever, people want to have names and institutions. They want to have this group of people being responsible for what's going on.
Yeah.
But when I read your essays, you don't really name names or groups. You talk about it as a... This is where I would like to understand more. It's like just a process that the humans are in, and it can't be affected. It's just part of our process now.
Mm. What I'm talking about is the evolution of systems of power.
Mm.
If you go back to the emergence of modern capitalism, was it 500-600 years ago? Yeah. Well, you can track the evolution of an earlier power system, you know, absolutism, whatever you want to call it, with, you know, when kings and the church and, you know, monarchs and despots, you know, ruled by decree. And, you know, you can track the history of the emergence of this new power system that basically came along and removed the power and the values creating authority from those old, you know, entities and transferred it to the marketplace, right? And this is where people have to understand, I don't have a problem with capitalism. You know, that's democracy. That's where democracy came from as well. What I'm trying to say is you can go back in history and track that evolution, right? What is happening presently, I believe, is another evolution. And it is particularly significant because it's what we're witnessing is the emergence and the nascent and the early stages of a truly global ideological power system. It's the first time in human history that this has been possible. If you go back to the 20th century and track that history, what I believe, you know, the highlights of 20th century history is what you're seeing is the expansion of capitalism reaching out and becoming more and more global and gaining power. And two reactionary forces rise up against that expansion, you know, one of which being, you know, Nazism, fascism, right? The other being, you know, communism, you know, and they both challenge. They both, these reactionary forces, you know, are challenging and trying to stop the expansion of this global, you know, capitalist ideological power system, and they fail. Global capitalism wins, right? And that conflict ends in the early 1990s with the dissolution of the Soviet Union. At that point, you know, I grew up, I don't know how old you are, but I'm old. I grew up in a world where the left actually had a foundation to critique capitalism and to fight for socialism and all of this. And that foundation was the Soviet Union. Love it, hate it, you know, whatever you want to think about it. But it was there. It was an actual ideological struggle. And that struggle ended. Anybody who's selling, you know, communism today, you know, is considered a, you know, a freak. Somebody who's a deviant. It's not a legitimate argument anymore. And it isn't because that argument is over. Let me get back to that because it drives a lot of people crazy. You were also talking about the names, the people.
Exactly.
And I want to say this very clearly, you know, for anybody listening, of course there are people with names running things.
Mm-hmm.
Of course there are. Yes. That no system runs without individuals running it. right? And you can track those individuals down and find out who they are and who their names are, you know, and you could go and again, hypothetically, you could go and shoot those people in the head today, and they would be replaced tomorrow by other people who would perform exactly the same function in the system that I'm talking about. So I'm not denying that those people exist. What I'm trying to focus my attention on is the system that these people serve and what the trajectory of that system is. Because I think I'm much less interested in why, for example, Elon Musk. I'm not very interested in why Elon Musk thinks he's doing anything. What I'm interested in is what is the role that somebody like Elon Musk is performing in the system in the context of its evolution at this moment. That's what I'm interested in.
The role he's playing.
That's right.
His function, basically, in
this
system.
That's right.
Because one of the things that maybe fits to this is what I found remarkable, because in today's debates about politics or whatever, it's a lot about ideology. Like, this is what I think is right. And then there's a certain bias and being very right about it. And you write about that this new system that you talk about, it doesn't even need ideology. And that found astonishing, because it seems like today it's all about ideology, but in your opinion, it doesn't actually need this. Can it just blend in with anything that's there?
Well, on the level that I'm talking about, the system on the level that I'm talking about doesn't have an ideology.
Yeah.
And the way I often put it is, its ideology is reality, right? Whereas, you know, 50 years ago, if you and I were having an ideological argument, you know, maybe I was arguing in favor of, you know, private enterprise and capitalism and, you know, free markets and what have you, and you would be arguing, you know, in favor of socialism and, you know, or social democracy or whatever it might be. And those are, you know, two ideologies, yeah, that are contrasting. The ideology, or I often call it a post-ideology, of, you know, global capitalism, globocap, I call it sometimes for short, the new normal Reich, whatever you want to call it. The ideology of this system, yeah, because it doesn't have an ideological adversary, it doesn't need to argue anymore. Its ideology becomes reality. If you challenge it, if you challenge its reality or you challenge its ideology, you're not a political opponent with an argument. You're a crazy person, yeah, who is sick in the head. You're a conspiracy theorist.
Because you're denying reality, basically.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, who would challenge reality except crazy people, right? Listen to the words. You're an extremist. You're a conspiracy theorist. You're a terrorist. You're a COVID denier. You're an anti-vaxxer. You know, all of these, none of these words have political content. These are words to describe people who are abnormal, who are aberrations, people who don't understand reality.
Mentally ill. Basically.
Mentally ill people. So when I talk about the system not having an ideology, that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about how it immunizes itself and basically does away with any legitimate political opposition before it can even begin. The ideological fights that you're talking about, to me, this is bread and circus. You know, who was it? Frank Zappa, I think, that said, you know, politicians are the, you know, the entertainment division of whatever, of the empire. I forget what it was. It's somebody can look that quote up.
I think of the military-industrial complex.
Thank you very much. Of the military-industrial complex. The culture wars, and this is, to me, this is obviously a way to keep people distracted, enraged, you know, and at each other's throats.
Yeah.
Right. It's if I can get the people on the blue team, right, to just, you know, obsessively hate everyone on the red team, and the people on the red team, you know, to just want to kill all the people on the, and then nobody's looking at me. Nobody's looking at the system.
Yeah.
Right. They're all just tearing each other's eyes out. That's the way I understand the ideological fracas that you were referring to.
Mm. And so that picture that you just made, because there's a paragraph where you write about this system, in order to exist, it must not exist. So it can't be seen. Is that when you also talk about there's these two people arguing about vaccine and masks and whatever they're arguing about, and they're not even looking to who is imposing those masks?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It is that, but it's more than that. The point that I was making when I wrote that is, again, if you go back to 20th century totalitarian systems, you know, there's like big ass, you know, statues of, you know, Stalin,
mm-hmm.
right? The Nazis running around waving big swastika banners. Let's, you know, have a big, you know, thing in the Olympiastadion. Their whole thing was, look at us, right? We're in charge, or we want to be in charge. Look at our symbols, believe our ideology. And this system, in this aspect, is exactly the opposite, mm-hmm. right? If you talk like I talk about it, if you start talking about, you know, this global capitalist system that has no outside adversaries, then people say, oh, well, you know, what he's really talking about is the Jews. Mm. You know, he's one of these crazy conspiracy theorists, you know, because he's talking about globalists.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about globalists. I'm talking about a system. But suddenly we can't talk about that anymore. Suddenly we can't track the evolution of, you know, human power systems, you know, through history up to the present anymore, because that's crazy talk.
Mm. The critique of power or accumulation of power is already crazy talk.
Yeah, like. Exactly.
And how do you think, how is it achievable that the majority of people is not seeing this system, this totalitarianism coming in, approaching, or slowly coming in? What are there any ways to hide it, or doesn't it have to be hidden?
Well, I think people are seeing it.
Yeah.
Do you know of course, you know, the Red Evening, in English, you know, you can't see the forest for the trees.
Yeah.
And I think people are seeing the trees very, very clearly. Mm. I don't think people are stupid. I think people are seeing the trees very, very clearly. What I've been trying to do is shine some light on the forest.
Mm.
Right? It's the same thing. It just depends on where you look and how you look at it. And I think that it behooves us. I think it's crucial that we also see the forest and not just focus all of our attention on the trees.
Mm. I think maybe that fits to my question, because I have one of my favorite authors. You might know him as Rainer Mausfeld. He's a cognitive scientist.
I don't.
And he talks a lot. He writes just a lot about democracy about, you know, the origin of democracy and what he thinks is going on now. And, you know, in some words, basically he describes it as a show, like democracy as a show almost. And I thought of you as a playwright, you know, like a theater that is put up for people to see, you know, just like you said, the reds against the blues. And he's making this whole argument. This is actually a way to sell power or accumulation of power to people so they don't resist, because it's democracy. So you wouldn't resist against democracy, because that's why people always, or politicians like to use the term democracy. We're fighting for democracy. And behind that, though, there's accumulation of power or control or these things. So when you hear people in Germany, we have this now a lot, you know, politicians say we have to fight for our democracy. We have to do this and we have to fight against the AfD. What do you hear when you hear the slogan, we have to fight for our democracy?
What I hear is actually kind of complex. It's funny. We were talking before. I just finished this 7-week road trip in the USA, driving all around the USA, gathering with people, and in some cases doing readings from my latest book. And the essay that I was reading from in that book is called The New Normal Left. Mm-hmm. And this is an essay that I wrote after I gave a talk in London. And I was trying to explain what happened to the left, right? And I think it's difficult for a lot of people to grasp. A minute or so ago, we were talking about the evolution of global capitalism, right? And I mentioned that's democracy. And it is, and it was. You know, I come from, my roots are liberal. I was an old liberal. I was, you know, when I'm pressed, I describe myself as an old lefty. All those liberal democratic rights, and principles and all of that, that was part and parcel of the evolution and the rise of capitalism and global capitalism. This system that I'm talking about, that I'm proposing, is evolving into a totalitarian form. This system is a system that saved us, that rescued us from the despots and from the tyrants of the absolutism period. Mm. And as it did that, as it transferred power and values from those structures to the marketplace, right? It gave us what we know of democracy, right? Anti-racism, you know, women's rights, civil rights, all of these things that, you know, liberals or former liberals think, all of this was part and parcel of the evolution of capitalism. Mm. One of the points in that essay that I try to make is, you know, hoorah for capitalism. Yeah, that's, you know, where what we have of democracy, this is where it came from. Right? This is where it came from. And it is still evolving in that direction. It's that now I have to get into the complicated stuff. Ideologically, what capitalism does, democracy does, it moves into a territory, into a despotic territory. Right, the old territories of absolutism. And it decodes all of the values of those despotic territories, despotic societies. In other words, your society can't function anymore on values like, you know, we are the master race, you know, and black people are inferior, mm-hmm. right? This is a value that is, you know, that is asserted by power, right? And that's what it's based on. It's based on, we have the guns, and so we'll say, you know, what this is and what that's worth, and so on and so forth. Capitalism moves into the territory and says, hey, Mr. Tyrant, Mr. Despot, you don't have that power anymore to decide, you know, who's the master race and who's inferior, or, you know, whether women can vote or anything like that. From now on, the marketplace, the market is going to determine all of our values, mm-hmm. right? And in the market, there are no values. The only value in the market is exchange value. It's commodity value. It's whatever, you know, whatever this glass is worth, on the market at the moment today. Mm. All right. Long digression to get us back to here. That machine, maybe I made it sound negative right there, but it's that machine. It is that machine that has decoded, you know, the racism from Western societies, which I'm a big fan of. I don't like racism. Yeah. It's that machine which has enabled people, you know, gay people and women to have more rights. It is that machine which is and has, in fact, spread democracy, right, all around the planet. At the same time, that machine now is the machine that I described a few minutes ago that encompasses the entire planet and that has no outside adversaries. And so that machine that brought us all these positive things, yeah, is what is evolving into a new form of totalitarianism. And the only real viable opposition that it has is internal resistance from people like Islamic fundamentalists who are saying, hey, we don't want to live in a big global capitalist marketplace, mm. right? We want to live according to our religious values. Mm. Or right populist opposition, which rose up and said, hey, we don't want to live in a big global capitalist marketplace where there are no values, right? And everything is just, you know, a commodity. We want to have our old traditional values and so on and so forth, right? And so the left looks at that and they, oh God, you know, so the choice that I have is this big global system, which after all is still doing good things, spreading democracy, giving people rights and, you know, dismantling dictatorships and things like that. It's still doing that, right? And if I don't like the, you know, authoritarian aspects of this, well, what are my options? Oh, I could become an Islamic fundamentalist, or I could become, you know, a rabid racist ethno-nationalist, mm. right? Basically a neo-fascist. And liberals, the left, are thinking, I'm going to align with the system. Mm. I'm going to align with the system because I cannot align with these reactionaries over here. So, yes, when the system is talking about democracy, yes, on the one hand, it's bullshit and it's PR, right? But on the other hand, it isn't, because it's still part of that systemic evolution. The reason, you know, I'm sorry, I'm going on and on, but at the level of the system, Bastian, when the system looks at a country like Cuba, right? This is just like, you know, this doesn't work for us, mm. right? Why doesn't it work? We need Cuba to be a marketplace. Mm. We need to get back in there and get our corporations in there and open Cuba up. Cuba needs to be a marketplace. It's a wonderful, you know, tourist destination, right? We're Trump Gaza, mm-hmm. you know, which is being planned. At the systemic, the system is just a system.
Yeah.
Right? And what it is seeing is Iran, what is all these millions and millions of people in the middle of the Middle East, and they want to live according to religious values? And no, we need to set up a shopping mall in there, you know?
It needs to be incorporated.
It needs to be incorporated, you know? They can just turn into Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is fine. Mm. Saudi Arabia is completely integrated in the system. They can have a little, you know, a little fake simulated, you know, Islamic theocracy, cut people's heads off if they're gay and stuff. Like, we don't care what you do at home. Mm. But they need to get, you know, with the program, get integrated. Mm.
One of the key things that I see then there is it's favorable for this capitalist system to have people that don't have value. Is that correct? If we erase value, you know, it could be God, it could be something else. It's easier to manage people without having strong values.
Without having actual mm-hmm. values. If what I'm talking about is the difference between, you know, I mean, it's fine if you want to be a you know, a Christian, fundamentalist Christian, go to church on Sunday and, you know, say all your fundamentalist Christian stuff, what have you. But if you actually try to live your life and structure your society according to Christian values, you know, then we've got a problem.
Then there's the problem.
I just brought up Saudi Arabia. It's fine to be a, you know, an Islamic theocracy at home. You cut people's heads off for blasphemy and they're gay and whatever. That is all fine. But if you want to structure your whole country, actually structure your society based on your religious values, you know, like Iran and the few Islamic fundamentalist countries that are left. If you want to do that, that's a problem. Right. So fake values are fine. Simulated values are fine. But having actual values, trying to impose those actual values on the marketplace, that's a problem.
Yeah. Because it reminds me of, it's a different area now, but you probably know the Milgram experiment.
Yes, of course.
And, you know, there's people hurting other people, you know, by order, you could say.
I wrote about it in my banned book.
Yeah, I mean, I knew it, you know, but the parallel that I see there is when they asked the people who didn't like to do it or who didn't do it that much, they had some value. They had some source of moral or value that was above the doctor telling them to hurt other people.
Sure.
That's why I came up with this. To me, it's a parallel to not have actual values, because then people can do or would do whatever is ordered to do.
Yeah.
You know, that's like on a psychological level, it makes a lot of sense.
Yes. Yeah. Well, again, yeah, if you don't, you know, if you don't have any actual values and you don't even believe that there are any actual values, then again, you're pretty easy to manipulate and you're kind of the perfect population for a totalitarian system. Mm. You know, another example of this, I used to drive my actors crazy. Another example of this is, you know, and we take it for granted. We don't think about it. I used to ask my actors, you know, this is back in the 1990s downtown in New York. And I would say, you know, who's the greatest, you know, living actor? And they would say, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman and, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis and Meryl Streep and so on. I said, no, it's Arnold Schwarzenegger, right? Why? Because that year, Arnold Schwarzenegger made the most money, mm-hmm. right? People can go off and have their little, you know, cults and values downtown New York. You know, we can all, you know, say, oh yeah, no, Schwarzenegger sucks and blah, blah, blah. And that's fine. The system doesn't care about that, right? But the actual values in our system, in our new system, are established by the marketplace. I urge people to step back from their social media feed or whatever news they read, or just pick up a newspaper and look at how many stories are reporting things like, this product was just released and it, you know, made this amount of money, or this movie just came out and this was its box office taking on its first weekend. It's like, who cares about the box office of a movie if you're just a regular person? You know, is the movie a good piece of art, a good piece of entertainment? You know, if you step back and start tracking how often our system is sending us the message. I mean, why is somebody like Elon Musk, you know, influential at all or important, right? Is it because he's a, you know, brilliant intellect, you know, it's a philosopher that has new things to tell us? No, it's because he's a multi-billionaire, right? What I'm trying to get at is the difference between what we desperately want to think of as our values and the actual values of the system that we all live in.
You just said about if you step back and, I don't know, you step back from your social media accounts or whatever you just said. I just read some essays from you on my way here. And at some point, I felt a little bit of a relief. Mm. Because to me, in that perspective, not taking those players too seriously, but looking at the dynamic, looking at the overall evolution of what's going on, it also brought me relief to know I don't have to get into this ideological fight about this party and this politics and this person. I can just step back and, you know, breathe and say, well, it's a play. But on the other hand, it can also lead to demoralization, to people thinking, oh, if it's a global capitalist system that is invisible for most of us, that you cannot even replace anybody because it wouldn't change anything, then I think people would also think, well, what do I do now? And I know from reading your articles, you don't give any hints or solutions, what I think is great. But I mean, do you cope with it well to see, well, it's just a big system I can't really do anything against?
I don't think I ever said that we can't do anything against it. Mm. My answer to this, and it frustrates a lot of people because they want to do something, and they want to do something now. Yeah. They want to know, you know, what should I do? And my standard answer to this is, first of all, understand the actual forces that we are dealing with. First of all, understand what our world is and what are the forces at play. Mm. And then maybe you can figure out something to do. Yeah. If you don't understand the world that we're living in, if you don't understand what the actual forces are that are at play, then whatever you're doing is probably not going to be so effective. Mm-hmm. And I understand that people are desperate for things to do. That being said, of course, there are things to do. There are always things to do. You know, it's, you know, the people reporting on what Israel has done and is doing in Gaza, all of that is important. That's doing something. I've called the Twitter files a limited hangout, right? But at the same time, I said that's an incredibly important story. You know, I would have, if I had been any of those journalists, I would have reported the same thing. I would have done it. That's doing something. You and, you know, I and Stefan Homburg, you reported the Robert Koch Institute files. Mm-hmm. Which is incredibly important and is huge. All of those little things are doing something. Mm. Is reporting the Robert Koch Institute files going to alter the trajectory of this global capitalist system that I'm talking about? Probably not. Mm. Okay. Does that mean that this is not worth doing? No, absolutely not. Mm. Of course it's worth doing, because every little thing that you do creates a ripple and it spreads. What I'm trying to do is maybe provide people with a context for what's happening that might make sense and might help them interpret whatever they're focused on, you know, in that context. Mm-hmm. At some point, I don't know when it was, but people were, you know, getting very frustrated with me and my analysis. And I asked people, I said, if you don't like my analysis of the last, you know, 35 years or 500 years or what have you, give me yours. Mm-hmm. Tell me what you think is going on. You know, tell me what you think happened, you know, forget 500 years, from 2016 to where we are now. Tell me your story, you know, make it make sense, because that's what I'm trying to do. Mm. Yeah.
It's interesting, because I spoke about Mausfeld, the author that I like so much, and he talks about it's very important to actually understand who are the relevant figures that are in power or that have influence. Mm. And it seems like some of what you do, to me at least, it sounds like is the same, is talking about what is relevant or what's the real deal, I would say it, behind those little, I don't know, arguments about, you know, which party to vote in, whatever. It seems like you're trying to offer an analysis that you suggest these are the relevant things going on. This is where one could focus on if you want to make a change or something like that.
I don't think that's exactly true. No? And I think that's where people get hung up. So, you know, some people read my analysis and they write in and they say, you know, well, what should we do then? So, what should we do? I don't know. What do you want to achieve? Mm-hmm. You know, maybe you know, if you answer that question, then maybe you'll begin to know what to do. I'm not writing an instruction manual, right? The only thing that I know to tell you what to do is understand where you are and the world that you live in and the forces that you're up against. You know, an example of this is, it's the reason that I keep hammering on it. Like I said, I have a lot of conservative readers that got on board with me, you know, during, before COVID, during the, you know, the whole Russiagate ridiculousness. This, you know, I covered all of this. This was the system responding to this right populist rebellion that rose up that I was interested in, not because I'm a right populist. I'm not. I was interested in it because it was suddenly a viable force that was pushing back against the advance of the global capitalist system in the same way that Islamic fundamentalism, which I'm also not an Islamic fundamentalist, but I'm interested in it because it remains an impediment to the expansion and to the domination of the global capitalist system that the system is focused on eradicating, right? An example, yeah, of what I'm talking about is this right populist movement, this right populist pushback. I don't believe that this movement ever understood what it was actually opposing, right? Because that's the irony of this. If you talk to the right populists, I mean, all the right populists that I know are, you know, they love capitalism. They defend capitalism, you know, with their last dying breath, right? So when I propose to them, hey, what you're opposing, what you're pushing back against is actually the advance of global capitalism. No, it's not. You know, it's, you know, wokeism or it's cultural Marxism or it's, you know, corporatism or some other name, some other thing that isn't global capitalism, but it actually is global capitalism. And I have challenged some of these folks. They would say, it's not, you know, it's not global capitalism, you know, that we're opposing, you know, we with our value, you know, and everything. I would say, they would say, it's cultural Marxism. I said, okay, then tell me the history of the emergence of cultural Marxism. All right. When did it emerge? How did it evolve? And, you know, present me with a story of the history of cultural Marxism, you know, from 1990 until now. And they can't do it. All right. What I'm trying to say, Bastian, is, you know, my analysis, it's not a replacement for anything that anybody wants to do. You know, it's not a replacement for you know, any course of action. It's not about a course of action. It's about trying to understand the world that people want to take action in. And if you don't understand the world that you're in, your action is probably not going to be very effective.
That's a good point. I come to the end of my question. One thing I really was interested in, I read about Robert F. Kennedy Jr. praising your book. And he says, C.J. Hopkins is our modern Jeremiah. No other prophet has described the strategies or predicted the perils of the emergent totalitarianism with such persistence and eloquence. And the same Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is now the ones that I read who wants us all to be wearing wearables that collect our medical data and then wants to have them in one cloud. And it seems like this MAHA movement or Make America Great Again movement basically is part of global capitalism, isn't it? If, you know, if just taking this example of our data.
Well, I wouldn't put it exactly that way. And again, this is where it gets very complex. And I don't know if I have the energy to describe it all. You know, what happened to Bobby is Bobby joined an administration. He signed on to a team, and he became a good soldier, right? And so it's not just Bobby Kennedy talking anymore. It's the team talking. And this is why I don't join teams, because I need to be able to talk and not parrot the propaganda of a team. Yeah, and this is what's happening. I believe that Bobby Kennedy's good intentions are still there. But he's also now a good soldier for the Trump administration. And he is subject to God knows what forces, you know, are at play coming in, pushing the wearables, pushing the, what's the weight loss drug? The Ozempic?
Yeah, exactly.
It's once you join a team in Washington, D.C., you know, people should understand that they're not listening to Bobby Kennedy Jr. anymore. You know, they're listening to, you know, Team Bobby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thanks for coming and sharing your perspectives.
It's a pleasure.